Welcome to Brains, a podcast exploring the inner workings of our brains, mental health, and disabilities, and how film and television portray them. Hosted by me, writer-director Heather Taylor.
And by me, film and television editor Sarah Taylor. Before we begin, we want to acknowledge that the lands from which we recorded this podcast and from where you are listening are part of territories that have long served as a gathering place for diverse Indigenous peoples. And we are thankful, as guests on this land, to be able to live, work, and gather here together. We continue to learn about the history that came before us and encourage you to do the same.
Welcome to Season 3 of Brains. Can you believe it?
Woo, 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 woo!
Today we have the pleasure of talking with New York Times bestselling author Bassey Ikpe about bipolar 2 disorder, how she got her diagnosis, and the representation of bipolar and depression on shows like Atlanta, Insecure, and Dave.
Bassey is a Nigerian-American, ex-poet, current writer, constant mental health advocate, underachieving overachiever, and memoir procrastinator. Her book, I'm Telling the Truth, But I'm Lying, is available in both print and audio.
A quick reminder to our listeners that this interview should not be taken as medical advice, and it is for informational purposes only. Because everyone's brain is different, please consult your healthcare professional if you have any questions. A content warning, on this episode, we talk about suicidal thoughts and hospitalization. And now, Bassey.
Bassey, thank you so much for joining us on Brains.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here. Super excited.
Well, to start things off, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name is Bassey. I'm a writer. And I enjoy long walks on the beach. I don't. I hate the beach. I hate sand. I watch a lot of television. That's a thing about me. So much television.
You came to the right place.
So before we jump into talking about television, I think the topic, you know, we're talking about today is bipolar disorder. And in your words, in your perspective, what is bipolar disorder and how does it present for you?
I don't like this question because I always feel like I'm being a doctor about it. But bipolar disorder is a mood disorder. It's characterized by high highs and low lows. So there's spectrums. And actually, just recently, I read about a third one that I cannot pronounce, but starts with a C. I was diagnosed with bipolar 2 disorder in 2004, 2005, around then. And bipolar 2 is considered the less severe of the two. And in the middle between the third one. And I think I'm actually the third one. I need to talk to my psychiatrist next week because I think I'm more the third one. So bipolar one has mania, which is what people are familiar with when they talk about bipolar disorder. It's the, you know, the whirlwind hurricane and the depression. Bipolar two has hypomania, which always presents as a personality defect, as in irresponsible, bad with money, overtalks people, like just things that are like, oh, she's a weirdo or whatever, that it comes off as a personality thing as opposed to a mood disorder. It's a misconception that bipolar 2 is less severe. It's just differently severe. I think that the depression with bipolar 2 is much more, I think, drastic than, because usually what gets the most attention for bipolar 1 is the mania, because it's so out of character. Whereas our mania just seems like, girl, save your money, like that kind of a thing. I was diagnosed with rapid cycling mixed episode bipolar 2 disorder. And again, now that I've read about the third one, it's clearly the third one that I have. What it is that I can be depressed and hypomanic at the same time. I can wake up hypomanic, go to bed depressed, or vice versa. Whereas people kind of like within a year, they'll have a hypomanic episode. Within 3 years, they'll maybe have a depressive episode. I'm in and out all year long, in and out. I've had in 2012, I had my last like severe depressive episodes, and I've had like smaller ones since then, but like the ones are like, oh, get thee to a hospital or we got to figure something else. That hasn't been the case. I've been hospitalized twice, should have been hospitalized 3 times, but I refused. It gets to a point for me where it's like, I'm sick of this. Like, I am so tired of this being my life and I can't go another 40 years doing this, is the way that I was thinking about it. So I was like, I'm not going to go. What happens, happens. But thank God I have family and friends who do the just try, just take, like, go up on your medication, go to the therapist 4 times a week instead of 1. Like, let's try. And I'm like, fine, we'll try, but I'll show you that it's not going to work. It worked. So here I am. And I actually started writing my book during that time. So it was a pretty productive depression. It was productive.
Yeah. Can't ask for a better depression. Yeah. It's productive. Come on. So how did your life change after you were diagnosed with bipolar 2 and after the hospitalizations that you had?
When I was diagnosed, I was diagnosed under like unusual circumstances, which is that I was on tour with Deaf Poetry. And I think throughout my life, I'd learned the tricks of the trade so that when I was down, I would just kind of disappear. And when I was younger, it would mean I was just quiet. I'm reading all the time. And it just seemed like, oh, she's studying. She's a reader. And then when I got back up, I would just do all the things that I didn't do when I was lower. Mm-hmm. As a kid, I didn't have like depression. I had like sadness and I took things really hard. And I know now that I had anxiety then. I didn't know what it was called then or what it was. So I sort of lived my life in this like cycle of up, down, up, down, up, down. And I'd learned to time it. Like I'm very good at timing mm-hmm. it. To this day, I'm like, ooh, I'm a week away from a thing. Let's handle it. So I was able to sort of time and like figure out what times of the year, like, you know, all those kinds of things. And again, I'd learned when I was in elementary school, middle school, high school, I would read a lot so that, because I knew that when the depression hit or the sadness hit, I wouldn't be able to do anything. So by the time it hit, I literally read my textbooks from cover to cover. During like the hypomanic stage, so that when it was time to write the paper, when it was time to take the exam, I already had the information. I didn't study last night, didn't write it last night, but I got it. Of course, you can't do that in college, because in college, you've got, you know, every professor is giving you 18 books. And so my little trick stopped working and I did terrible in college. My first semester, I got a 0.0, I was just flat. I could not do anything. I went to the campus counselor for the first time. It was like something. I don't know what, but something. And it's gotten worse since I was a kid. And I was very disappointed in the way that went. Miss Benita Jackson, I'll never forget her name. And it was just kind of like, she just sat there and watched me as I was talking and didn't offer really anything and didn't really say anything, just like writing her notebook. And I was like, oh God, I hate this. I've since learned that I need to tell the counselor / therapist the kind of counseling / therapy that I want. But at the time I was like, you're supposed to take the wheel. Like, you know, like you do this. But it was like, I was like, I'm not doing this again. Every once in a while, I'd like stop into something. I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. But yeah, so I was on tour, and because I didn't have the room, I had to be backstage by 6. I had to be on stage by, like, I had this like schedule. I had to be on the plane or on the train or however we got to where the next city was. And I just couldn't keep it up. It got to the point where I would literally cry in my dressing room, stop, get on stage for 3 hours, go back to the hotel room, literally lay on the floor, cry until the next morning, and then, you know, just do it all over again. I cracked. Like there was just no way for me to sustain it. And I started losing a lot of weight. I was already like kind of, you know, a smaller person, but I started losing a lot of weight. Our stage manager, Alice in Atlanta, again, I'll never forget this, kind of pulled me into her hotel room. Like, what's going on? You know, we're taking in your clothes a lot. You're not socializing. Cause I was out there with the people. She's like, you know, what's going on? And I was like, nothing, I'm fine. And I had just broken up with somebody. And so I was like, people are really good at like understanding heartbreak. Like, oh, she's heartbroken. That's what it is. But if you say anything else, they just kind of like, well, I don't get it. Just be happy. So I leaned on that breakup a lot. And then it got to a point, we were in Chicago, the crying that I could usually stop once my makeup was on didn't stop. Like it just did not stop. I was doing, somebody told me that I was self-regulating. We didn't know those words back then. So I was like, I would turn, I would like shake my body, like dance and all these things just to like get whatever it was out. And it didn't stop. Like I just kept crying and crying and crying. And I ended up in my dressing room underneath the sink. Cause like one of those standalone sinks in the room. And I just crawled under there and I'm just like weeping. And the wardrobe person came in and was like, what's going on? And I told her to go get Alice, and Alice literally crawled in with me and like kind of pulled me into her lap. And she's like, if you don't get help, you're going to die. And I did not know what that meant. So I was given a leave of absence from the tour, and they were like, if you don't see somebody, you can't come back. Like, you know, you just can't. And I wanted to be back on tour. So I went and I saw 4 or 5 doctors in one day. Like, no, I saw 3 doctors and one like homeopathic lady who like read my chakras and all this stuff. Each one, I told a different part of the story. And so I walked away with like a fear of failing, fear of success. Somebody gave me anorexia. The chakra lady said that my something was misaligned. It was just like, I was just telling people what they needed to hear. And I finally got to the last one, Dr. Tiago. And by the time I got to her, it was in the evening. I was like, I'm exhausted and I want to sit here and lie to you, but I am so tired and I need help. And she just started asking me all these questions and I was answering them or trying to answer them. And then she's like, I have an idea, but I, as a therapist, I can't diagnose you with anything. So I'm going to give you, I'm going to call my colleague. She called Dr. Goodman and said, you have to go right now. And she could just tell that I was about to run. I'm a runner. She was like, I called him. He's expecting you. And she was like very firm. He's expecting you. And so I ended up going within, I don't know, 15 minutes. I had a diagnosis and I told him, no, I don't. So thank you very much for all of this. Appreciate your time. But Black people don't get bipolar disorder. I'm also not crazy. So thank you. It was one of those things where I was relieved because when he read off the list of symptoms, I was like, oh God, yes, yes, that too. Like it was a checklist. It was a checklist, except for one, which made me really mad. I didn't get like the hypersexualization. I was like, all this time I could run around doing things and just blame it on that. I was like, I didn't get that. But everything else was like, was checklist, checklist, checklist. And I was relieved. But then I was also very scared because you want a name, you want an answer, but you don't want that answer. You don't want that to be it. So I didn't tell anybody. I was terrified. I didn't tell anybody. I kind of just used like the stress and all that stuff kind of excuse. And they still wouldn't let me back on tour because I had to be gone for a certain amount of time. And I still was not talking about it. There's a television show that I watched that was like, okay, you can talk about this. But I'd already been hospitalized once because I stopped taking my meds because I was told by AppleCare that you take your meds, you're good, you get to live your life. And I was like, all right, I'll take them for 30 days, antibiotics, kick that bipolar out of my system, and I can have my life back. And of course, it doesn't work that way. They didn't want me back on tour. I mean, they wanted me back, but they were afraid of having me back so soon. And I was like, that's not what I signed up to. I was told, I see a therapist. That therapist sent me to another guy. That guy said I need to take medication. I'm taking it. Taking it for exactly 60 days, more than I thought I would. And I just stopped taking it. And I crashed so hard. And that was my first hospitalization. It was a pretty bad crash. And I write about it in the book. I was afraid to be home by myself. My roommate was out of the country. I was afraid of being outside because there were moments where I was like, I had to like, you know, in the train, the subway station, I had to like literally press my back against like the map, the subway map, because I wasn't sure I wasn't going to just sleep in front of a train. I wasn't sure. Like I'm pretty sure I wouldn't, but also wasn't confident that I, you know what I mean? Like I didn't know. And I remember wandering around Manhattan, just trying to like, I don't know, snap myself out of it. And there was a moment when I was standing on the corner of 14th and University. It was in Union Square. And Union Square, when I first moved to New York, was the first place I knew how to get to by myself. Like I knew how to get there. So I was there a lot in the park and they had a lot of vegan restaurants around and it was just a really cool place. And I knew to go there. I went to Union Square, but I was on the corner of 14th and University. And it was like traffic, like this car was coming. And there was a moment where I was like, I could just step into the street and it'd be an accident. Like, oh my God, it was an accident. Poor Heard, it was an accident. And that scared the crap out of me. And my friend saw me walking by a restaurant, just trying to like, she saw me inside and she came in. She was like, are you all right? Let's get some food. And she brought me in. Cause again, I was deathly, I'm an emotional not eater. So I was just very, very thin. Next day I ended up in the hospital. And the hospital was good for me, in that I had nothing to do but work on myself. But I still wasn't ready to tell people. I still was not ready to let the world know. I was comfortable with depression for some reason. I was comfortable saying I was depressed. I had depression. I was sad. But the whole like thing I wasn't ready to do until I saw that episode of Girlfriends. And that's when I was like, okay, I have to, I don't have to, but I need to, I want to, I don't want anybody to watch this show and feel as disappointed as I felt. So I started like, before it was called a blog, it was like a web journal. And I started like on my website, just like everything from beginning to end, and went to bed. I was like, well, now they know. And I came back and there's a lot of people had like commented, and like my mom, my sister, me, and you know, my dad, my cousin. Mm-hmm. And it's just very like, I don't want to say gratifying, because I hate for anybody to have this, but more than that, I'd hate for anyone to have it and feel like they're the only person.
Yeah.
Or the only one in the world who's experiencing it in this exact way, or in this typical, or in this particular way. So that was my first hospitalization. I've only been hospitalized twice. And the second one was like very, very boring. So I was like, I'm checking myself in. No one has to drag me. I went in, I was like, I need this, I need that, I need to go up this way, I need this to happen. Like I was there for like a vacation. I was there for 5 days, in and out. And ever since then, I've just paid so much more attention to my moods. Like I say, I can time it. Mm-hmm. I know when to like sort of back away from people. I know when to say, this thing is coming, so help me. If you see me online at 4 a.m., call me. If you see this and that, ask me if I've taken my meds. Like I'm the person you can say, hey, have you taken your meds? And I can say, oh, no, I didn't. Or yes, I did.
You touched on Girlfriends. Can you tell us what it was about that episode you watched that, like, because I didn't realize that you hadn't told anybody. I thought you just hadn't been public about it. So what was that episode and why was it so impactful?
So back then in the early 2000s, Girlfriends was the number one show in Black households. Mm-hmm. Like it was every Tuesday. That's what, if you're Black, that's what you were doing. You're watching Girlfriends. Oh, let me back up a little bit. I'd seen an episode of Oprah that had Sunny Corinthos from General Hospital and Jennifer Lewis. And they were the first people of color that I'd seen her talking about bipolar disorder. And Jennifer Lewis being a Black woman, I had a strong attachment to Phyllis Hyman, who died when I was in high school. And just not really understanding why, but hearing the story and being able to identify with the story without having like a diagnosis myself. So anyway, I'm sitting on the couch watching Girlfriends, and they had a friend, Lynn, who was like the fuck up of the group. Like everyone else was like successful, had their like careers, had families. And she was just like, she was always living on somebody's couch. She was like in and out of like, she was always in school, in and out of relationships, in and out of like just the one that was always never had any money, like the moocher, the one that would just come in and go into, like she was like that person. She was also like adopted, I think, by a white family. So she was like just getting it. She was like a very hippie, you know, Lisa Bonet type character. And she had found her birth mother. And she was trying to figure out like why her mother gave her up for adoption. And the mother was like talking. And then she found out that I think she was really wealthy. She came from a wealthy family. So it was like, why am I up for adoption? Somebody told her that her mom had bipolar disorder. And I remember sort of like on the couch, like freezing, like, is this it? Is this the moment? Is this going to make it easier for me to tell people? Because they're going to do all the heavy lifting for me. But what happened instead was that they said this woman had bipolar disorder. They gave her the characteristics of somebody with like a developmental delay. Mm-hmm. And also like at the time, multiple personality disorder. Now it's DID or dissociative identity disorder. So they were giving her like, it was like bipolar is like the trademark, like it's Kleenex. This is the thing that people will recognize. But we need to zhuzh it up for television. Oh, so they just gave every single thing. And I remember sitting there being so like disappointed. But then there was a moment when Joan, Tracy Ellis Ross's character, and I had beef with her for 20 years because of this. Lynn was like, I'm afraid that this is what I am. Mm-hmm. And again, knowing what I knew and knowing all the character, the symptoms and characteristics, and having watched this show for X amount of years, I was like, yes, Lynn, you might have bipolar disorder. And Joan says to her, no, there's nothing wrong with you. You're not crazy. You're nothing like your mother. And I'm sitting there on the couch like, well, goddamn. Like,
yeah.
This was the moment. Like, y'all were supposed to help me out. Mm. And they just didn't. And I was so heartbroken and so disappointed and so, like, concerned. I was concerned about the person who didn't have a diagnosis, who was watching this, knowing something was wrong and having absolutely no connection to what they were showing. Because there was also this thing of like, oh, I don't have that, so I'm fine, that I thought was going to happen as well. And so I started writing about it because I don't want to be alone. So it's a very selfish thing, but I don't want anybody else to feel alone as well. So I would talk about it all the time on stage. Before I left the stage, I'd have this whole conversation with the audience. If you feel something, go check it out, type of thing. And then that's it. From there, I somehow became an advocate, and it's been on and popping ever since. I don't know.
You know, your reaction to not getting the answers you wanted or not having it be a thing where you're like, hey, watch this episode and it can explain how I'm feeling is exactly why we started Brains.
Yeah.
Because we would watch so much stuff and be like, what the fuck are they doing?
Yeah.
And it would be so disappointing. But we've also discovered through doing this podcast that there's some great examples of things that are done well.
Especially now.
Yeah. And we love to focus on the things that are people who are doing it well to encourage others to also do it well. You came to us with so many amazing examples. Thank you. I was like, great. Like,
I've been waiting to talk about this. Let's go.
I'm like, let's go, everyone. But I think the one that you, we'll talk about a few things, but the one show that you really brought out and you wanted to talk about, which I think we should, is to talk about Atlanta and the depiction of a character experiencing depression that you don't really notice. So let's talk about that and what signs were missed and how did that reflect on your own experiences?
What was interesting is that all the signs were missed because during the run of the show, you have these other characters that had more immediate issues. Like Earn was, you know, he dropped out of school and he's, you know, has no money and he's depressed about that, or depressed like this thing is making him sad. This thing, you know, so you're watching him very, you see it, you see the arc. Van, also, she's Earn's daughter's mom. And you see her go through these stages where she's like kind of lost, doesn't really know herself. And she kind of like runs away to Europe and leaves her. Like it's all these things that are obvious. You see it. Oh, there's that. There's that. We have Paperboy who is trying to deal with fame and like keeping himself and also dealing with the loss of his mother. And like, so again, we see it. And Atlanta does this beautiful job of using like Afro surrealism to like depict what's going on in emotionally. But you're watching the show, you're like, this is so weird. This is an invincible car. Weird. Like all these weird things are happening on this show. And then you got Darius, who is the fan favorite. Darius is hilarious. Darius is a stoner. Darius just loves weed and doing weird things. There's an episode in season two, Teddy Perkins, where he goes to buy this color piano from this person who's doing like a whole like
that was a
Michael
good,
Jackson
yeah.
thing.
So freaky that episode. Yeah.
Oh, so scary. I watched it a million times. I literally bought that episode from iTunes.
Love it.
Like
yeah.
I bought it. I own that episode. So if anything ever happens, I can watch. But yeah, so you see that and you're like, this is so weird. Like this is so out of character for Darius. Like he's actually met somebody weirder than him. He's so scared. Da-da-da. And of course, you're not like laughing that he's scared, but it's such a good episode. So you get to the finale, the series finale, and the one person you don't worry about, you don't worry about him at all. He's fine. Darius is the one that's giving advice to everybody else. He's so calm. He's so, you know, he's the yoga master. Like he's just like very shaman-like. And then you realize that he was the one you're supposed to be worrying about the entire time. The entire time. He was the person that you were supposed to be like, hey, what's going on with Darius? And people would say that, but they meant it in like, what's going on with Darius? As opposed to like, is he okay kind of way. And I literally just watched it again because I've seen it a dozen times, but I wanted to make sure that I wasn't like making it bigger than it was.
Yeah.
But watching it and seeing that he had created this entire world for himself. So all of the weirdness that we were seeing could have been him trying to cope with all this stuff. And when you go back and look at it, because I went into an entire rewatch and you see him become a real person. And when you see that he's dealing with this unimaginable grief, like his brother, his entire family is gone. And you see these little subtle things. His brother is dead. It's not actually, he's not actually there. And then when he picks up the picture, the frame, you hear his brother talking to him, and all of a sudden it's black. It's not like, you don't see him anymore. He doesn't respond, but Darius is speaking to him like he's responding. Mm-hmm. And he's like, how's mom? How's dad? Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, his entire family is gone. And then there's a part where he says, when he first hugs his brother, he says, I don't want to stay here or something like that.
Yeah.
And his brother's like, oh, you don't want to be here or something like that. And it's just like, oh, if you want me to stay, I'll stay. He's like, no, mm-hmm. I don't want you out. Yeah. I don't want you here. Go outside.
Be with your people. Friends. Yeah.
So good.
So good.
So good. And yep. I'm just sitting here like, oh my God, we should have been worried about Darius mm-hmm. the entire time. And even the scene where he's in the car with, he gets in the car. This is what I picked up today. That was his anxiety. All of that, London mm-hmm. was a personification of his anxiety. All the stuff, because when she was running away, she was like, this is all your fault. And like, that's anxiety. You know, like it was just so much about that episode just put so much into perspective, not just about that character or the show, but just the way that you can't tell these stories straight. Because if you do, you have to zhuzh it up. You got to make all this stuff up in order to like get people interested in it.
Yeah.
So it's important for it to be surreal. It's important for it to be depicted in a way that mirrors or mimics what it actually feels like to go through something like that. So going back to Teddy Perkins episode, that's Darius. Like, that's the person we could, and I remember watching the Teddy Perkins episode. I was like, that's traumatic. Like, there's gotta be some PTSD. Next episode, he better be, not better be, but next episode, he's gonna be fucked up.
Yeah.
Next episode, he's barely in it. He's in one scene where somebody says, we're living in a simulation, and Darius goes into a whole Darius thing. And I'm like, ugh, Darius. I thought something was wrong. But then again, going back to the finale, you're like, that's Darius.
Yeah.
The guy who was so scared. And now I'm just remembering, about to cry, when he's like, he's chained up to the chair and he's like talking to him, like, it doesn't have to be this way. And like really like connecting with him. And then going again to the series finale, you're like, holy crap. We should have been worried about Darius the entire time.
Yeah.
He's the one we should have been concerned about.
I'm getting shivers.
Right? Yeah. Right? It was just so perfectly done. And it wasn't telegraphed. We didn't know it was a show about any of the stuff that we were watching. When the show first came out, it was about a guy who manages his cousin's rap career. And I was like, I'll watch it, but I'm not going to like it. And next, you know, it becomes like this complete, like, so good.
So good.
Yeah.
Oh, so good.
I'm curious. So I've had bouts of depression in my life, and I found in the finale of Atlanta, those moments when he woke up from the tank and you thought, okay, I'm out of, okay, I'm clear. And then you're like, nope. We're not there yet. And you wake up again.
Nope.
Like, did that resonate for you when you made the connection, like, oh, wait a minute, Darius is dealing with depression. He's dealing with something more than just being like a stoner.
Yeah.
Did you feel that really connection of like,
yeah,
the actual feeling?
I did. Yes. It was so, again, it made it visceral.
Yeah.
You know, you felt what you saw, what he was feeling or what he was meant to feel. The part where he was upside down in the tank mm-hmm. right after he saw his brother. And like in the depth, you're not supposed, it's, you stay flow. You don't
supposed to
turn.
Tip, yeah.
You're not supposed to tip over. So he's head first. I'm like, oh my God, we're losing him. Like I was so scared that we're going to end with Darius not being with us anymore. I was terrified. I love that character from the beginning, but yeah, it was all of that. Like all the, like the weirdness that he was hearing, the Judge Judy touch point where it's like, I need to remember that I'm a real person.
Mm-hmm.
Based on something outside of me,
mm-hmm.
so real.
Mm-hmm.
That's so real. I need to remember I'm a person outside of this thing that's taken over me in some way.
Oh my gosh, that's so impactful hearing you say it. Wow.
So good.
Yeah, you have to remember you're a person outside of that. Sorry. You're making me cry too. that's good. Sorry. Whew. Get the feels anyway.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I loved it. I'm very into shows that do stuff like that. I really am.
And I think it's so helpful because a lot of times what happens is in a show, you're like, oh, you deal with it like episode of the week, like the one episode, like you were saying, like with girlfriends, we're like, oh, you're fine. And you just find out about this and then it goes away. Or it's like, I remember this from like Riverdale had Betty Cooper had ADHD and took pills in the pilot and never did again. So like, wait a minute, does she have that?
There should be more.
Like, what's happening? Yeah. That episode of the week thing versus like what the reality is of the people in your life and what they may be experiencing that they may not be telling you about.
Yeah.
You have to like look further mm-hmm. into like yeah. the people around you and what they're experiencing.
Totally.
When I was writing my book, one of the things I kept in my mind is like every person you bump into that's rude to you, the lady at work who just doesn't speak to you and you're like, oh, she's the worst, or, you know, all kinds of things. You don't know what people are actually going through and the way that they're learning to deal with it. I think that one of the issues when it comes to mental illness, no matter which one, is that if people don't like you, they can't empathize with you. Mm-hmm. So it's easy for people, and I go through this all the time, it's easy for people to like, oh, Bossy, I feel you. But like the Kanye, he's crazy though. Like Kanye, fuck that guy. Mm. He's choosing to be like this. I'm like, okay, if you get it here because you like me and because I'm a lot quieter with my and I'm a lot more self-aware in a way, you gotta understand. Like I will explain to you. I it's textbook. Every time he does something, I see exactly I'm like, oh, it's about 4 o'clock, it's coming. Like I see the trajectory. I see it every single time it comes up right before an album. People are like, oh, he only does that right before an album because he's trying to sell an album. Or he stops taking his meds because he thinks it makes him more creative. Yes. Therefore, by the time the album comes around, he's spiked. Like, come yeah. on, people. Like, let's talk about it. But like, that's the thing. Like, people think that you're only allowed compassion if they like you, if they understand, if your thing doesn't make it difficult for other people to live. Mm-hmm. And that makes it very lonely because yeah. you don't want to inflict yourself on people. That's something I had to learn for myself. So when shows do that and show that they're still like part of the framework, I was watching something else and I saw the person take pills and it wasn't a big deal. They just took the pills and then put them away. So yeah. So when a character just like, you just go in the bathroom, takes their pills, comes back out. I'm like, hey, so what were you saying? Like, it just, that kind of, it was Nate from Insecure who did that. It's just part of the conversation. It's just part of what you're doing. It's your everyday. And then learning to be self-aware about it within a television show with other people. And it's not just loss. It's not Jesse Spano high on caffeine for that one episode. Like it is,
yeah,
yeah.
You know, it's a whole thing. Yeah. So.
Let's talk about Insecure.
Love that show too.
The end of season three, it was like Nate or
Team Lawrence over here.
I will never forget. Lawrence?
Team Lawrence. Team Lawrence from the beginning. Lawrence was depressed in the
You're
beginning.
You're right. He totally was. Yes. That's fair.
He was depressed. And everyone's like, he was a loser. He didn't, like, he was depressed. How dare you?
Oh, you're right. Love but Lawrence. Nate was like also great.
Boo.
Boo. I'm staying out of this. Okay. I'm neutral.
Team Lawrence.
Okay, that's fair.
All the way.
I'll take it. I'm Team Insecure. That's what I'll just go down that road. Anyway.
Team Issa.
Yes, yeah, Team Issa. No, yeah, not Team any dude. Team Issa. Okay, so talk to us about the storyline of Nate. You know, what was good about how they, you know, they talked about it and showed his bipolar on screen?
Again, I am the bipolar whisperer. So I had all kinds of like, he's got bipolar. But like, no, he doesn't. You want everybody to be, no, he's got it. And then when I was validated, I was like, hell yeah. Because all the things that you think are like, oh, he's so spontaneous. Oh, he just likes to break into houses and go swimming. Oh, he likes to have sex on a Ferris wheel. Like all this, he just pops up places and he disappears. And everyone's like, oh, he's just so flaky. He's the worst. He is the worst because he's not Lawrence. But he's not the worst because of his behavior.
Yeah.
So there are things like that that they kind of like sprinkled in when he kind of just disappeared. And even the episode when he disappears and Issa's like, is like, where is he? Like, even that was a good depiction of that kind of like anxiety, like frantic, like, I need to know what's going on. And then when he disappeared, I was like, okay, I know the disappearance. Mm-hmm. I know when you don't know enough about yourself or the other person yeah. to say this thing is going on. So you just go away
yeah.
until it comes back or until you can come back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I also recognize how difficult it is for people when you do that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they depicted that very well. You can't just disappear from somebody's life and expect them not to be affected by it. Mm-hmm. They did a really good job in a different way from Darius's character, where they were very upfront about it, but they also were very good at making sure that the symptoms felt real life. They didn't feel like like put on. And then there was an episode in the last season that was just him. I was like, you could have had Lawrence. But anyway, but it was a good episode because it showed like his relationship with his family, and his cousin's wife didn't really like him that much. And it was because he had acted very erratically when he was living with them. And, you know, all those things that you feel like you're in a vacuum, but your symptoms don't exist in a vacuum. Other people are affected by it. And I thought that was a really good thing to show. And then, but that really got me, even though, again, Team Lawrence, I was like, ready, like, Nate, go away. I'm ready for you to go. But when he said, this is not good for me, this is not this kind of back and forth, this confrontation, I'm trying to stay healthy, this is not healthy for me. And he left. That is... He didn't have like a breakdown. They didn't show like the really dramatic choice of having him be like wild and fighting Lawrence. They did it so well and so quietly. That's what I love about these shows. They do it so quietly that you don't even realize what they're doing until you have to think about it. Until somebody says, did you see the way that, and then there's a conversation that's built. And I think that's much better again, like than the episode of the week where they're not talking about it again.
Yeah.
But when you're able to look back and say, oh, this thing and that thing and this thing and that thing, it does something. It does something. Oh my God. Same show with Tiffany who had postpartum.
That was so well done.
So well done.
My
favorite episode doesn't have anything to do with mental health, but it kind of does. I'm going to make it so I can talk about it.
It's okay.
Low-key happy. The episode where, no, it actually does. When, oh, good. I'm gonna make this work. Watch. Okay. So Issa and Lawrence they reconnect and they're at dinner and they're talking about like how she's like, you didn't make me feel like you wanted anything to do with me. And he basically says, I was depressed. He didn't say that he's depressed, but he basically said that he was depressed. I've been saying he's depressed since season one, episode one, but you know, they want to call him a loser. I knew what was going on. But just like that thing where, again, your mental health affects other people and you don't see how it affects other people until they tell you and they don't know to tell you because they don't know what they're looking at the same time. So watching them have that conversation where he's explaining to her what's going on, she's understanding and explaining to him how it was from her side. Perfect.
Yeah.
Team Lawrence. Perfect.
Okay. You're making me change my tune.
You have to watch it again from the lens of him struggling with depression.
I should have clocked that. I did clock it, but I didn't. I might have just.
You were too wrapped up with Nate.
I was just too wrapped up with his beautiful eyes. Anyway, sorry.
He's got some gorgeous eyes, though, really. T. Lawrence, though. My bad. His eyes were much better. He's got two of them. They're great.
You're right.
The other show that you flagged in terms of bipolar disorder specifically was Dave. And Gator.
That gave you a lot of names.
I know, you have so many. There's so many shows and other shows, which I'm like, I just want to talk. Well, we can just talk to you for 5 hours, right? Yeah, that's fine. But just speaking specifically about bipolar disorder, you were saying that like Dave did that a good job of portraying Gator, like his manic episode in the first season finale. So like, how did you feel like it represented bipolar disorder?
Well, they mentioned it early in the season and he said it so like this, I have bipolar disorder. Like it was very like,
cash.
I have a cold, I have the flu. Like he was very, you know, about it. But when you watch him, you see, yeah, he does. Like the way that he kind of just looked at the world, he's very eccentric already as an artist and as a rapper and as, you know, like sort of this care. They always give them like this carefree kind of like, oh, I come and go when I please type of thing. And then you look at it and you're like, oh, he comes and goes. Mm-hmm. Like that's part of it. Mm-hmm. It's all part of it. I didn't rewatch the entire season. I just watched that last episode. But what I loved about that last episode was that his mania was irritability. Mm-hmm. He was irritable. Mm-hmm. He was just like, he was paranoid. He was taking everything personally. The thing with his mother signing the house over to his sister and how like knowing, like I have a younger sister who is the responsible one. Like she knows all the info about our parents and all that stuff. I cannot be trusted. And I know that, but it's still difficult to know that other, like pretend, like at least act like I'm part of this. So seeing that and knowing exactly what that looks like and why it looks like that. But also seeing how frustrated he was and how upset he had just taken his meds. And then he comes out and like, it's like another reminder.
Yeah.
You're still not all the way okay, even though you're doing everything you're supposed to do. And that's part of it too, that I think is important. When you look at symptoms, it's easy to be like, no, no, no. Until you see like a real life correlation, because people, when like one of the symptoms is paranoia. And for me, I was like, I don't think anyone's trying to kill me. Like, I'm not being hunted. That's the way I thought paranoia was. But when you look at it, it's like somebody's mad at me.
Yeah.
Somebody in the world is upset with me. They use a period where they usually don't in their text messages. They are pissed. That's paranoia, but people don't consider it that. So it's easy to like look at these symptoms. That's why I love these shows. It's easy to look at the symptoms and not relate until you see them, until you see the way they present. So you see Gator irritable. You see him like all of a sudden the friend that was his friend all season is not his friend anymore. His family doesn't think he's responsible. So he's going to start selling. He's going to make more money. He's going to sell random things in order to make money because that's going to make him look responsible. Like all these different things. He's coming at his friend as opposed to talking to him. Again, the irritability. For me, it was just the agitation and the way that it showed up. Because I'm always very aware of the fact that these things look like you're just being a jerk. Like you're just being like selfish or arrogant or all these different things when there's like so much more going on. But what I loved the most about it is when it looked like Dave, like he didn't care. Like he was just like, what's wrong with you? Like, actually, let me tell you what's wrong with what I'm mad about. And then that last shot when you see, because they mention the Gator's name is Dave and then you kind of forget it. And then when you see the Dave and you're like, oh, got to watch a Little Dicky concert, huh? And then it's Gator that comes up. I was like, oh, they listened. He got his thing. Like this, he wanted to be validated. He wanted to be seen. He wanted to be acknowledged. And sometimes that's all it takes is that look, is that yeah, I get it. What can I do? Like, how do I make this? And in that instance, it's a big concert on stage thing, but in real life, what is that? Like, how do I see you? How do I make it better? How do I make it easier?
Yeah,
not better.
Yeah.
How do I make it easier?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I think people tried to, how do I make it better? And that's never the right things. Like, how do I help you? Where do I stand for you to like see that I'm still here? Like, where do you want me? I can be behind the door and like crack it. Like, where do you want me to be? And I think that was such a really great visualization of where do you want me to be? I'm not where you need me to be. I haven't been there this entire episode, but I see it now. Like, where do you need me to be? He didn't get pissed off because he was yelling at him. He was like, my friend needs something. That's what I was so disappointed in Girlfriends about. It's like, there's a way to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, you don't have to say, and this is my friend, and I am now going to be there for him. You just be there. And you see the connection between when he thought nobody was there for him, when he thought he was alone, and when he thought that, like, nobody was trusting him and was blowing him off. You saw all of that. So you see like the depiction of him being brought back up. It's just, yeah. I thought it was just, and then to see like the date, the show was called Dave. And then all of a sudden knowing the entire season was about Gator.
Yeah.
I love surprise.
Yes.
Like fool me.
Yeah.
Like fool me. Like make me like, make me want to watch it four times because it's so good.
Oh yes. I think there is becoming so many better examples of this. And I think the things that we're talking about are showing more of the subtlety of it or the different manifestations that things can have. But on the other side, we haven't talked about this, but like, what are some of the, you know, kind of going outside of television or things that can be seen in television that are not good depictions, but what are kind of the, maybe the common stigmas that you've experienced than people like, oh, bipolar disorder, then X.
I think it's using bipolar as the trademark.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then giving it all these other things. I think that mood swings are part of it, but the mood swings are like minute to minute, you know, and I guess it's economy of time maybe, but it makes people think that it's just that, like at 5 o'clock, she was fine. Now it's 6 o'clock and she's this, and it's 7 o'clock. This will happen too. And like, again, I have rapid cycling. So that happens in a way, but it doesn't happen in a way that other people would notice.
Right.
It happens in a way that I notice and I know.
Yeah.
I don't like it when the whole point is just to get somebody into a hospital. Like you don't hear anything about this bipolar at all. And then they're diagnosed at like, you know, minute five, and then half an hour into the show, they're in the hospital now. And it's just all about that. And then I don't like depictions of the hospital too. I don't think that they're Disney World, but I don't think people place enough emphasis on how important it is for you to be there.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the regrets I have in my book is that I didn't place enough emphasis on how important it was for me to be there because I was too focused on realism, I guess, on my experience at that time and not like I left and I realized I needed to be there. I was just talking about the time in there. And I think people walked away like, yes, hospitals suck. And I'm like, no, hospitals are great. Like if you need to be in a hospital, be in a hospital. So a lot of like the psych ward depictions or the behavioral health unit depictions are, I just think are designed to scare people. These shows don't make people feel safe about the way that they feel, whether they have a diagnosis or not. They don't feel safe with those emotions because they're going to isolate people. They're not going to be able to have relationships. And which, I mean, I personally, I get triggered too easily by relationships. So that's not my world, but I don't think it's a universal thing. I think that you shouldn't let that be the reason why. And a lot of these relationships on shows, they ended because this person was this. And it just, I don't like that. The polar opposite of that is making it too accessible so that you've got people self-diagnosing and then thinking that, well, this is less television, more like TikTok and stuff like that, where it's like, this and this is a trauma response. I'm like, for you, it is. And maybe for her too, but it shouldn't be presented as a universal, because now what you're doing is encouraging people to self-diagnose, take the diagnosis, do absolutely nothing with it, and then get on and start misrepresenting this thing that they just kind of gave themselves.
Yeah.
I think that's really dangerous. I think that's actually more dangerous than television and movies, because these are real life people. So it's much easier to identify with them and see yourself, because it's literally somebody in their bedroom, mm-hmm. like me. One of the reasons I stopped calling myself a mental health advocate and I started saying mental wellness or just something else, because for me, it's life beyond the diagnosis. Like usually you get diagnosed and you just stop. That becomes your personality. You just only see yourself through that lens. What does it look like to live with it? Like, what is your everyday? Like, what is it to just take your meds and go about your business, or take your meds and still have a shitty day, or, you know, forget to take your meds, or, you know, like these are all like very normal everyday type shit. And it's not just this sort of living in this thing. There are certain things I know that I personally cannot do. Don't give me a Fortune 500 company. It will fail immediately because it's not my temperament. That's not the way my brain works. And a lot of that is because of my diagnosis. So I already know not to do mm-hmm. that. I'm not going to put myself in that position. Mm-hmm. So people trying to put themselves in positions that don't align with their diagnosis, I can't think of another word to say it, and then feeling like failures because that person had this thing and they did it. How come I can't do it? It presents differently for you. So you got to find a different way to do it. You can still do it if you want to, you know, but it has to be done a different way.
I'd love to know where people can find more about you and follow you, and where they can find your book.
I'm Bossy World on all platforms, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. And my book, I'm Telling the Truth But I'm Lying, is available wherever books are purchased. And if you DM me, I will send it.
Amazing. I've been listening to the book and she sounds lovely. It's Bessie records it. So if you want to listen to her lovely voice, then you should listen to the book.
It's on Audible.
Yes.
Amazing.
I can send that to you too.
Well, we just want to say thank you so much for coming and joining us and talking so much about everything on television, just the tip of the iceberg of some of the shows that are doing a really good job with representation. So just thank you so much for coming on and also sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you for having me. And I really appreciate this podcast. Like I said, when you emailed me, this is my life. I've been waiting, thanks for finding me. No, but this is a fantastic thing. I think that it's really important that people have places to have these conversations. Because I think that people sort of devalue, it's really cool for writers to be like, I don't watch television. I just read encyclopedias. Television is great. And when it's able to do this and people are able to come together and have a conversation, I think it's fantastic. So I'm really grateful that you guys exist. So thank you for having me.
Thank you.
I love chatting with Bassie, and I also love that we're back for season 3.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
That was so loud. It's good to cheer. It's good to be loud. It's good to be proud.
Yes, I've learned from my sessions with my therapist that I have problems expressing joy, specifically as in I don't share what things make me feel full of joy except with people that I trust very closely. But I'm really open to talking about trauma.
That sounds familiar.
I'm joyful about our podcast.
I'm joyful about our podcast. I'm joyful about chatting with Bassie, and there were so many moments in that interview where I was goosebumps tears in the eyes.
Yeah.
She's bringing so much important work to the world. And I think she's just a treasure. And I'm glad that we got to connect with her and talk about some of my favorite shows. Oh my goodness. We did go on for a very long time, and we love her and we want to talk to her forever and ever and ever. So thank you.
It's so much fun when you connect with someone. It's such a, yeah, it just feels like every time we interview someone on our podcast, we're like, ah, oh, they're our friends for life. Like, because I just want lots of friends.
Well, no, because we share, I think we're lucky that we get to do this job and we like learn about somebody's lived experience, but we often, like anybody, I think we can see ourselves in a lot of different people's stories, yeah, which is why we love to do what we do with our film and television work.
Yes.
And then we have a connection, and that's just part of being human. And I think it's pretty freaking awesome. So yay.
Agreed. Agreed. Something that isn't freaking awesome is that what is awesome is I got to spend some time in Los Angeles, which was amazing. I had lots of amazing meetings. I thought I would be able to have a relaxed approach to meetings, and I 100% did not. But I did get to enjoy the sunshine, and my arms are tanned and I feel happy just from just walking outside. And then I returned to New York, where I am part of the year. And it was, for those in Celsius, it was like, I don't know, 4 degrees. It was like 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And I was like, what is happening? I reject this weather. This is not where I want to be. So I'm trying to come to terms with it. And our heat is broken in our house. So we have no heat and it's cold outside.
No.
And I just returned from being in like the sunshine all the time. And like literally being like walking on the beach in Santa Monica and Venice. And then I return home to Queens and it's so cold. What am I doing here?
Well, you get the best of both worlds.
That's true.
So I think you win in the end.
I do win in the end. I am grateful for that. But I can still feel sad about cold weather.
Your body is still allowed to feel cold.
My body is still human, even though I want to be a robot. Bing, bang, bong.
So I've been following Lauren Groves and her work with her her practice and at Ignite Counseling and Wellness. And they are now doing a Reclaiming Body Trust retreat, which is something we talked about in our episode about shrill and fat representation. And so for people local to Alberta, or more local to Edmonton, on April 27th and May 4th, they'll be doing this body trust workshop. And I think it's just fantastic that it's coming back. And if you're in the area and you're interested in doing some of this work, I highly recommend checking it out. So Ignite Counseling and Wellness is her company, and she will be putting on this, I think, wonderful retreat. So yay, Lauren.
Good job, Lauren. I'm excited. That's exciting. I think that if anyone who listened to that episode and was really inspired by it and wants to attend those, there you are. There's a workshop that will be local to you if you are in Edmonton/Alberta. If you attend, let us know. Let us know how it is. So I was going to the airport on Monday night, and I was on my phone in the back, as you do. And then the driver's like, look up, look up. And he opened up his roof, like of the car, like opened it up. And I could see what looked like, well, it looked like a missile. I was like, what? Like, I was like, is there a war happening? Like, it was a little freaky. I went on Citizen app. No one said anything. And I'm like, what's going on? And so I took lots of pictures of it, but I'm like, it looks like a rocket ship, like when a rocket goes and you see things coming off of it and the way that the stream behind it was dissipating. I was like, it's not a plane. I took lots of pictures of it thinking I need to figure out what this is. And then I saw later on Twitter, someone mentioned it was a Falcon 9 rocket launch. So I got to see the Falcon 9 rocket launch, not knowing what it is. And guess what? It's kind of scary when you don't know what's in the sky. Number one, it made me think about the new film Civil War that's coming out about the war in America, Civil War in America. But space innovation, hurrah, that's the thing that I prefer. So so Falcon 9 rocket launch from Los Angeles, so near Los Angeles. And I just thought that was a really cool thing to witness.
What a great way to start season 3. So excited. Thank you for listening and being here with us. We love brains.
We do love Brains.
Brains is hosted and produced by Heather and Sarah Taylor. It's mixed and mastered by Tony Bao, and our theme song is by our little brother, Depish.
If you like what you hear, please rate and review us and tell your friends to tune in. You can reach us on Instagram, TikTok, or Twitter at Brains Podcast, spelled BRAAINS Podcast. You can also go to our website, brainspodcast.com, where you can contact us, subscribe, and find out a little bit more about who we are and what we do. Until next time, I'm your host, Heather.
And I'm your host, Sarah. Bye.
Bye.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.